Ireland is famous for its eloquent literary heritage, even if some of its writers might leave you scratching your head.
On his tomb, there's a very famous epitaph. It says, "Cast a cold eye on life, on death, horseman pass by." Growing up in Ireland, none of us have any idea what the hell that means.
Coming up, friends from Ireland explore the legacy of its celebrated 20th century poet, William Butler Yeats. A leading journalist of today at the Irish Times reflects on growing up in Dublin in the 1960s.
I think it was a bit of a grey place.
Fintan O'Toole explains how he's grateful things have changed a lot in his lifetime from the harsh atmosphere of his own school days.
It was violent, it was anti-intellectual.
And a guide from Belfast encourages us to visit Northern Ireland.
And people will be as curious about you as a tourist as you are about Ireland, so you'll get a warm welcome.
Let's get to know Ireland in the hour ahead. It's Travel with Rick Steves. Ireland is a great place to make friends. Coming up, a prominent journalist at the Irish Times reflects back on a lifetime of social change he's witnessed. In just a bit, Fintan O'Toole tells us what it was like to grow up during the stormy 1960s in Dublin. And a guide from Belfast recommends why it's worth your time to include her region of the UK on your next trip to Ireland. Let's open today's Travel with Rick Steves with an appreciation of one of Ireland's most quoted writers. For such a small country, Ireland's literary impact is profound. Poet W.B. Yeats was the first Irishman to win the Nobel Prize in Literature back in 1923. As we're about to find out, Yeats' poetry also helped set the stage for the newly independent Republic of Ireland. The only place I've ever seen a poet working as a street busker was in Dublin. I'll never forget this guy. He was like a street musician, but he did poems by request, only in Ireland. What is it about poetry in general that the Irish are so enthusiastic about? To explore that, and specifically the poetry of W.B. Yeats, we're joined by Barry Maloney and Stephen McPhillamy. Barry Maloney is a tour guide down in the south of Ireland, in Kinsale, and Stephen McPhillamy resides in the north, in Derry. Barry and Stephen, thanks for joining us.
Cheers, Rick.
Thanks, Rick.
Of all the poets in Ireland, Yeats is central. And just what does he mean to you guys?
Well, he's the national poet. He won a Nobel Prize for Literature. Loads of other accolades. We learn about him at school. Actually, when I was at school, I didn't like Yeats' poetry all that much. But to quote Yeats, "Then I was young and foolish." And as I've grown older, like, I've really got into his poetry now. And I think the guy's an absolute genius. Of course, the rest of the world knew that already. But I've just really embraced him, and a lot of his poetry has hit the mainstream. You know, he's quoted in movies and songs. And
well, what is genius about him? How can a young guy who's not inclined to like poetry suddenly recognize Yeats is a genius?
Well, a couple of things about Yeats' poetry. One is he led this movement called Celtic Twilight poetry. Like, he kind of reinvented Ireland almost at a time when we were in a very down time, like the late 1800s, just after the famine. Not everybody was interested in patriotism and cultural nationalism, but William Butler Yeats gave us a pride back. You know, he brought in Celtic crosses and mysticism and
It's kind of like
swirling and twirling.
Kind of like Robert Burns in Scotland.
Absolutely, yeah.
And same sort of thing, Victorian age and getting people a respect. And this was a time all over Europe that small downtrodden groups were, their spirits were bolstered by romantic writers and poets and musicians.
There's something in Yeats to suit everybody. His early poems are nature-based. His central ones are all about what was going on in Ireland at the time, like Irish independence and new free state.
Right.
And his later ones are all mystical, magical, and supernatural.
So he has quite a variety.
He's got some great romantic stuff too. You know, that old eternal topic pops up. Like, Yeats was haunted throughout his life because the one woman that he loved, he couldn't get her.
Okay. That
and that tortured him.
And that helps a poet be a better poet.
Unrequited love.
Yeah.
That's
right. And there's a lot of men, as we all know, we can't get the woman we want. So, you can always read about it in Yeats' poetry.
Or sit down and write your own poem. We're hearing how the Irish revere the poetry of W.B. Yeats right now on Travel with Rick Steves. Barry Maloney has written a guide to historic Kinsale, where he leads walking tours. And Stephen McPhillamy, recently retired as a tour guide, operates a guest house in Dingle and a hotel in the Swiss Alps. Mary Margaret in Muncie, Indiana, joins us on the phone now at 877-333-RICK.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. I would like to know, I'm going to be in Ireland, and what are the best kind of experiences that a person should do or go to really understand Yeats' poetry and how it affects us better?
Well, there's one brilliant first stop, and that is the National Library in Dublin. Mary, has a Yeats exhibition that's been running now for some years, and it is absolutely fantastic. It's free of charge, and you could easily be in there for half a day. And it's just got some great artifacts and exhibits. And also, Yeats was a very complex character. There was a sort of a dark side to him in his later life. And this exhibit does not hold back from presenting the full William Butler Yeats, warts and all.
So this is the National Library?
National Library, just Dublin. Beside the National Museum. And
because the
and
National
also the
Museum
Parliament.
Is one of the great museums. You got to see that. And while you're there, be sure to check out the National Library.
Yeah, and it's only 100 metres away or 1 minute walk from the National Museum.
Right.
So check that out first.
Barry?
Well, super,
well,
thank you.
My favourite place to appreciate Yeats is near Galway, Cool Park, where he composed a lot of his nature-based poems. It's seven forests of native Irish trees interlinked in a national park now, Irish National Park, and you can walk through the forest and from time to time read, presented nicely, poems by Yeats
in the
inspired
forest.
By the forest itself.
What's the name of the forest?
Cool, but it's spelled C-O-O-L-E, Cool Park.
C-O-O-L-E Park in near Galway.
Near Galway, yeah. And, you know, you could combine that, a visit to Cool Park, with a visit to Yeats' burial place.
Up in Sligo, up in Drumcliff. That would be the grand finale then, to go and see his actual grave up in Sligo in the northwest of Ireland.
So there you go. You got the National Library where you can learn the context. You got the forest on the west coast where you can walk and be inspired by nature and read those poems. And then you can go to Sligo and make your pilgrimage to Yeats' tomb.
On his tomb, there's a very famous epitaph. It says, "Cast a cold eye on life, on death, horseman pass by." Growing up in Ireland, none of us have any idea what the hell that means, but that's the whole point. It's very cryptic. And
say it again slowly so I can try to understand what it does not mean.
"Cast a cold eye on life, on death, horseman pass by."
So he just said that to cause you to think.
And thousands of people stop there every week. I bring tours from Galway to Derry and we stop off there. I got in trouble some years ago for telling the tour members that we would be doing a WC stop at William Butler Yeats' grave because that's what I wrote on the itinerary. And some people thought I should have worded it a bit better.
Oh, well, you learn with experience. Mary Margaret, thanks for your call.
Thank you, and thank you for the answers. I look forward to plugging that into my itinerary.
All right.
Thanks, great. Mary.
Sally's calling from Lavelle in Pennsylvania. Sally, thanks for your call.
My pleasure. Whenever I think of Yeats, I think of that beautiful, peaceful, alluring poem, The Lake Isle of Innisfree. It's always been my favorite. I was wondering...
Stephen loves that poem. Lake
the Lake Isle of Innisfree. Do you know that? Before you talk on, Sally, let's let Stephen read that poem.
This poem, it was even in that movie Million Dollar Baby with Clint Eastwood some years ago and Hilary Swank. The Lake Isle of Innisfree, William Butler Yeats. "I will arise and go now and go to Innisfree in a small cabin built there of clay and wattles made. 9 bean rows will I have there, a hive for the honey bee, and live alone in the bee-loud glade. And I shall have some peace there, for peace comes dropping slow, dropping from the veils of the morning to where the cricket sings. There midnight's all a glimmer and noon a purple glow, an evening full of the linnet's wings. I will arise and go now, for always night and day, I hear lake water lapping with low sounds by the shore. While I stand on the roadway or on the pavement's grey, I hear it in the deep heart's core."
Something about poetry in Ireland, it's like a declaration of life is real. We can be connected. We can appreciate it. Ireland is so full of beautiful nature, and to have a poem that can connect you with that, it's quite nice.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Any other thoughts, Sally, on traveling in Ireland and appreciating the poetry?
Well, I'm looking forward to one day traveling in Ireland, but I just think that hearing the poems of Ireland in the dialect of language and accent of Ireland is just magic, and I appreciate that.
You know, there's something about Ireland, you just learn there's more to appreciate about life. I mean, Ireland has lived so much heartache and so much joy, and it feels so real when you're there, and it's music. Of course, you can enjoy music in the pubs and in the song of the people, and it's also complemented by poetry, and in so many ways, the music and the poetry come together. And maybe that's in every country, but in Ireland, it's really accessible for the tourist, and that's what I like.
It's the emotion, you know? You mentioned the poetry, the rhythm, the traditional music. When you hear the traditional music in a pub out in the west of Ireland with a storm beating on the door of the Dingle pub, it will make you feel so Irish, and you'll want to beat that rhythm into the floor.
That's exactly it. Beat that rhythm into the floor.
Into the dance floor.
I love to take notes in a pub because if you're a creative writer, it's just like picking berries everywhere. There's just observations, and I always feel like people are stomping the paint off the floor, and you just said to beat the rhythm into the floor. And you got that, and you got the cigarette with the long ash that's yet to fall off of the cigarette, and you got the beer made with 6 pints stacked tall, empty pints, still with the froth on the lips, and you got all the twinkle in the eyes of the people around you, and you just feel like, whoa, I'm in an Irish pub. There's music, there's poetry. I'm a tourist, but I'm right there. Mm-hmm. Sally, thanks so much for your call, and best wishes in Ireland.
And thank you for bringing me a taste of Ireland right here.
All right. Stephen McPhillamy, let's sum this up with a little more Yeats.
Well, you see, my own personal favourite Yeats poem is called An Irish Airman Foresees His Death. This is about an Irish man who, in World War I, decides to join the Royal Air Force and go off and fight the Germans. And he's up there in the clouds in one of these rickety old early aeroplanes, and he's thinking to himself, why am I up here? I don't hate the Germans and I don't love the British. Mm-hmm. The reason it resonates with me is that my own grandfather, who was from Derry, an Irishman and a Catholic Irishman at that, joined the British Army and landed on the beaches of Normandy, and was probably the first time he'd ever met the Germans was when he fought them hand to hand on the beaches there. So I always think about him in this poem because I know that he didn't hate the Germans, and I know he didn't particularly love the British that he was fighting for. So this is called An Irish Airman Foresees His Death, written in 1919. I know that I shall meet my fate somewhere among the clouds above. Those that I fight, I do not hate, and those that I guard, I do not love. My country is Kiltartan Cross, my countrymen Kiltartan's poor. No likely end could bring them loss or leave them happier than before. Nor law nor duty bade me fight, nor public men nor cheering crowds. A lonely impulse of delight drove to this tumult in the clouds. I balanced all, brought all to mind. The years to come seemed waste of breath. A waste of breath, the years behind, in balance with this life, this death. This man was there for the sheer thrill of just being up there for adventure.
I can understand how you said Yeats is just genius, brilliant, and how it'd be easy not to appreciate him. And anybody who's going to Ireland might want to get familiar with Yeats before they go.
I think so, yeah. I really think it would be an enhancement of your Irish holiday.
Another parallel to that poem is Yeats was Anglo-Irish. His family had roots in England.
Right.
He was offered an English knighthood. He refused.
That is interesting because he's not your true blue Irishman. He's got English heritage. Mm. But he was empathetic with the Irish people enough not to take that knighthood.
He's an Irish nationalist.
And today he's recognized as a great character in Irish literature.
Yeah, I think he's universally respected, definitely.
That's right. Stephen McPhillamy, Barry Maloney, thanks for an opportunity to appreciate Ireland in a way we might not otherwise appreciate Ireland. This is so important for travelers to let themselves be poets as they adventure around this world.
Very true. Thanks, Rick.
Here's to Yeats.
Thanks, Rick.
Now they ride the wintry dawn where Ben Bulben sets the scene. Here's the gist of what they mean.
Actor Michael McLeamore reading from Yeats's Under Ben Bulben. Up next, Fintan O'Toole remembers what it was like to grow up in Ireland in the 1960s. Then we're off to Northern Ireland on Travel with Rick Steves. How much has the world you grew up in changed since you were born? Well, Fintan O'Toole was born in a working-class suburb of South Dublin and puts the profound changes of the past couple generations in Ireland into focus with his book, and it's called We Don't Know Ourselves, A Personal History of Modern Ireland. Fintan has long been a popular columnist for the Irish Times and is often called Ireland's leading public intellectual for how he writes about the issues and the people of his country. Fintan joins us now on Travel with Rick Steves to share what it was like growing up in Ireland, an Ireland you'd hardly recognize today, in the 1960s. Fintan, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's a real pleasure, Rick.
Now, your book really is kind of built upon the changes in your country since the year you were born in 1958. So let's just say your earliest memories were from the 1960s. And when we go to Ireland, as so many Americans love to go to Ireland these days, we have a kind of a fun little exercise to imagine what Ireland was like back in the 1960s in a simpler time, you know, but we have a hard time really making that vivid. Can you help us? What was Ireland like in the 1960s?
So I think if you'd gone to Dublin, the capital city, which is where I grew up in the early 1960s, you probably would have been a bit taken aback by how, you know, dowdy and derelict some of it looked. You know, it's a sort of 18th century classical city, but it was pretty down at heel. Yeah. Economically, the place had been in a bad way for quite a long time. So you would have seen a lot of buildings that were...
Did it have its wonderful colored doors? You know how you paint the doors in Dublin now different colors, a whole rainbow of colors.
There were certain places where that was still done,
yeah.
But there were also a lot of those beautiful old Georgian houses, as they call them, you know, from that Georgian period, were sort of empty. And
then,
I think towards the end of the 1960s, you know, as I was getting older, you would have begun to see a kind of revival of those sorts of things.
Also, when you talk about gray, the image of Ireland when I go through villages is pastel, delightful painted cottages and all the beautiful colors on the buildings. And I look at photographs and there was no paint at all.
Yes, yes. You know, I think it was a bit of a gray place. Now, the upsides of that. So, I mean, if you were a visitor and you got a bit of money, you know, the food in Dublin would have been great and you could afford it. You know, you could eat very well.
Yeah.
And then if you went outside Dublin, you know, you went around the countryside. I mean, it was fantastic in one way, I would have thought, because there just weren't all that many people there. You know, you could really go anywhere. There was a real sense of the countryside. The rivers were very, very pure. I mean, it was a fantastic place for people who were interested in fishing, angling, you know, salmon. It was very unpolluted compared to a lot of America or a lot of Europe.
And like an extended family, I get a feeling if you saw somebody on the TV entertainment show one night, you could probably see him in a pub the next night.
Absolutely. I mean, there were only about 3 million people left, you know, when I was born. It was very intimate, very religious, very, very religious. I mean, it was really dominated by the Catholic Church. We spent a lot of our time in the church. You would have seen, oddly enough, even though the population was quite small, you would have seen lots of kids around, right? So because the baby boom in Ireland was happening much later than in the US, you know, so beginning in the early 1960s, I suppose, you know, you begin to get a bit of prosperity coming in, a little bit of more people staying at home.
You got the change, like just threatening, and you've got the church having a grip on things.
Yeah.
You've got things going on in the United States, you know, you got the Summer of Love, the Vietnam War, you've got the assassinations of Robert F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King. I suppose that had ripples in Ireland for change, but the church and the status quo probably didn't want it. Was the TV, for example, a change maker?
Oh, yeah. So we had one TV station.
One?
We only got TV really at the start of the 1960s. And TV, Rick, was a huge influence, you know, because, as I said, we hadn't had it. And so we're experiencing this new technology for the first time. Albania had television before Ireland did, you know. They wanted to keep it out. The church wanted to keep it out as a bad influence. But they eventually did have it, you know, one national TV station kind of owned by the state. Most of the stuff on it, there were news programs and things like that, but most of it was old American TV shows. So they just bought a big load of cowboy shows, American sitcoms, I Love Lucy.
But did you have like Troublemakers? We had the Smothers Brothers and we had All in the Family and TV that was willing to talk about divorce. Or
no, we didn't, you know, have a lot of that stuff. No, we had all the sort of, we had the stuff that you guys probably would have watched in the 1950s, you know.
Okay, so you were a decade we were still behind watching us then.
You know, it was all black and white TV and it was these, so we were kind of behind the curve with some of that. Now, beginning in the, you know, in the 1970s, people started putting up these giant aerials and they could get BBC to television from Britain.
Wow.
And that, of course, had a lot more racy programs, a lot more controversial programs. See, you have to remember just how dominant the church was, right?
Yeah.
So books were still censored. Movies were censored. The censor would just cut, you know, they would just chop bits out of movies. So we never had this idea that the movie had a kind of continuous narrative, you know, that there was a beginning, a middle, and an end. You know,
wow,
we watched these movies
that.
just kind of jumped all over the place. So we thought, oh, that's the way movies are, you know. So it's kind of, I mean, it had been much, much worse. Famously, in Ireland, the censor had censored Casablanca, and it censored Casablanca to cut out all references to the fact that Rick and Elsa had had an affair in Paris.
Oh my goodness.
So you couldn't understand Casablanca. You know, the whole, well, we'll always have Paris. What? You know? So, you know, they would do these kind of completely bizarre things to try to avoid mentions of sex.
So crude omissions with no interest in what kind of ripples that would have in the script. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Fintan O'Toole, and he chronicles the changes in Irish society since his birth in Dublin in 1958 in his book We Don't Know Ourselves, A Personal History of Modern Ireland. It's been called one of the best books of 2023 by the New York Times. Fintan is a visiting professor in Irish Letters at Princeton University in New Jersey. There's more about Fintan's work with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. So, Fintan, I understand there was a very strict and conservative sort of chain of schools, Christian Brothers schools in Ireland, and you were a product of that?
I was indeed, yeah. I mean, they were pretty brutal, to be honest. You know, so it was all male, of course.
Ruthless. That's a hard word to describe your educational upbringing.
Yeah, you know, it was very violent. You know, there was a lot of corporal punishment, as they call it. So you were hit for almost everything. And this would be in primary school, like when you were 8, 10 years old. I mean, yeah. You were beaten for if you couldn't spell a word or whatever.
What,
you
know. I'm just curious, what kind of corporal punishment? Spanking or?
So they had what they called a leather, and it was a leather strap, a short leather strap, which was really, really thick. So it was about an inch thick. And so they would hit you with that on your open palm, mostly. And it really hurt. I can still feel the sting of it and the sound of it. You know, it was kind of terrifying. And then the really crazy guys would have big sticks, and they'd just beat people with sticks. Hmm. And, you know, it was violent. It was anti-intellectual. Now, to be fair, and it's always the case, Rick, isn't it? You know, there's always good people. There's always nice, sweet people who are well-motivated. So we all, you know, there were always some of these guys who were really decent and did their best under really difficult circumstances. Yeah.
How did they censor what you read? Because you're an intellectual now and all about, you know, being curious and open-minded. Did they work hard in what they let you? I mean, when you think back on the textbooks and the assigned reading, what was that like?
So what they tended to do was that, you know, the assigned readings were not modern, you know, but poetry, you would get up to, you know, William Butler Yeats and maybe one or two of the later Irish poets, because poetry was all right. You know, it wasn't going to be erotic usually. We didn't study, for example, James Joyce, right? So James Joyce, I think the greatest novelist of the 20th century, you know, revolutionizes the novel, revolutionizes literature, writes, of course, about the very city I was in. You know, he's obsessed with Dublin. Ulysses, his great work, is a kind of map of Dublin. Every detail of the city is in the book. And yet, you know, that was discouraged. Joyce was seen as a disgrace. You know, he was a rebel against the church. He'd gone to Paris and, you know, he hadn't conformed. You know, so that kind of thing, the women writers, a lot of them were banned, like Edna O'Brien, these wonderful young women writers who were coming along. So there was still a lot of censorship of literature. This was easing now into the 1970s and 1980s, but a lot of it still being around. The funny thing was, though, that people got hold of these books. So as you know, it was a very literary culture. People read voraciously. Oh, yeah. So it was this kind of very weird mixture of censorship and attempts to control. But a lot of the attempts to control really failed. So my father, who had never even gone to high school, he'd left school when he was 13 years old, self-educated man, you know. But he read Ulysses. Now, Ulysses is not easy to read, right? You know, but he could read that book, and he took me around the city and he showed me the places in the book. And because he found it in a way easy because he knew the places, he knew the voices, he understood it. So in one way, it was a horrible place to grow up because there was all this censorship and this kind of puritanical attitude to literature. On the other, it was fantastic because you had these great writers who had written about the city, and people did get hold of the books and did read them and were proud of them, you know. And so I grew up with that mixture where in school you learned a lot of historical literature because that was regarded as being okay. They taught us a lot of Shakespeare, for example. They don't seem to realize that Shakespeare is filthy, but, you know, if you really want to be, if you want filth, look at Shakespeare. But it was kind of old filth, so that was all right. But actually, you know, learning Shakespeare for me was one of the most wonderful things. I still adore all that work. And also then you had these Irish writers, these modern Irish writers, you know, whom you could find out if you really wanted. And I was lucky enough that, as I said, my parents were great readers, and my father, even though he wasn't well educated, read these books, had these books around the place. So I was able to imbibe all that.
And your family environment is probably very interested in your moral upbringing. Whose photographs, whose paintings are you going to find on the mantle or hanging in the kitchen?
Well, so you would have had religious pictures. So the Sacred Heart of Jesus, you know, was an image that was I remember it very much in the kitchen. The Pope, of course. But bizarrely, on the other side of the Sacred Heart of Jesus was John F. Kennedy. You know, Kennedy in Ireland was particularly because of his murder, which came very shortly after he'd made this historic visit to Ireland. He was kind of seen as almost like an Irish saint, you know, and so there was this kind of strange mixture of religious iconography, and Kennedy represented, I suppose, dreams of being modern, you know, of being part of the American world, which Irish people, I suppose, wanted.
Do you actually remember when he came? I think you were like 5 years old when he came.
What I remember most is the excitement of the adults. I suppose, you know, when you're that age, you watch your parents and the people, you know, the older people around you very, very closely, and you remember that. And I do remember the air of excitement. You know, this seemed like a wonderful moment for Ireland, because it seemed like a sort of homecoming, you know.
Must have been exciting.
All this pain of emigration, you know, because we lost all our people over the generations. You know, so many went to America. And here was like that Irish America coming back to us, and coming back to us in a form which wasn't about pain and embarrassment and humiliation, but power, you know, the most powerful man in the world, glamorous in his 40s, good looking, you know, charismatic, all that stuff.
Fintan O'Toole is often referred to as Ireland's leading public intellectual for how he writes about its issues and people in his twice-weekly column for the Irish Times. Fintan's book is We Don't Know Ourselves, A Personal History of Modern Ireland. It chronicles how Irish society has changed since he was born in Dublin back in 1958. Fintan is also a visiting professor in Irish Letters at Princeton University in New Jersey, where he joins us from their studios. We have links to his work with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. And Fintan, in your book, you wrote that John F. Kennedy was like both a disguise and a mirror. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think he was a disguise in the sense that, of course, he was, you know, much, much more powerful and glamorous and attractive than we were. You know, he is a way of trying to project a version of ourselves that was much more to do with how we wanted to be rather than how we really were. But there was also a mirror, because he said things, you know, which no Irish person would have said. So he said, for example, you know, he said, Ireland's main export is people. He didn't mean that as a mocking thing, because, of course, he was one of those exports, right? You know, he came from that export. He didn't mean it in any way insulting. But if you were Irish, you just thought, oh, God, that's true. And it's a terrible truth, you know. So even in the way that he was sort of explaining about the history of the migration and placing himself within that, it was sort of also painful. You know, he was showing us a reality. That visit by Kennedy was very exciting, but it also had that edge of saying, if we want to aspire to be modern, if we want to aspire to not have to export our young people, we have to change.
And Ireland really has changed, you can say, since then.
Yeah, it's changed almost beyond recognition in some ways, Rick. But the good thing is that the change is largely positive. You know, people can stay in Ireland. There's very low unemployment. There's you know, levels of prosperity that Irish people could not have imagined. You know, so all those kind of very positive, realistic, ordinary things have happened. But when I said change beyond recognition, there's some ways in which you can still very much recognize it as Ireland. You know, it still feels like a distinctive place, you know, a place that has its own story and its own culture and its own way of seeing the world. And that's sort of hopeful. You know, it means that you can change an awful lot and still have some sense of continuity in your sense of identity.
And reading through We Don't Know Ourselves, A Personal History of Modern Ireland, one thing you can take away is Ireland has come a long way in that one generation.
Absolutely. Absolutely it has, you know. And it's nice to be in a country where, by and large, and again, you know, all sorts of qualifications, but by and large, you can look at it and you can say, yeah, this place is better than it was. And it's better than it was because we made some good decisions, you know, and collectively and politicians, you know, we often, you know, not like get great pleasure out of knocking politicians, but some of them made very good decisions, some courageous decisions, and they've paid off in the long term, you know. And it's not now that we're by any means a perfect society, but it's that we now have, for the first time in our history, we have the resources to be able to actually fix the things that are wrong. You know?
And I think it's fair to say, when you look at it, that the Irish people have done that because they have organized, they have had embraced good governance, and they have worked together through their politics to make their island a better place and a more promising place for the young generation. Fintan O'Toole, thank you so much for joining us and shedding a light on a childhood in Ireland, way back in the 1960s.
It's been a great pleasure, Rick.
Fintan O'Toole tells us how he grew out his curly brown hair into an Irish afro as a school kid back in the 1970s. It's in an extra from today's interview. You can hear that and listen to his earlier conversations with us at ricksteves.com/radio. A tour guide from Northern Ireland explains what you can expect to find across the border in her quarter of Ireland. Tips for enjoying a week in Northern Ireland are just ahead. We're at 877-333-7425 or by email, it's radio@ricksteves.com. As a matter of principle, I think a trip to Ireland should include both the Republic, that's the about 75% of the island that's independent with Dublin the capital, and Northern Ireland, and that's the bit in the far north that remains part of the United Kingdom governed from London. Often overlooked, Northern Ireland is a land of rugged beauty and deep and a complicated history and a warm welcome. Stops in the vibrant cities of Belfast and Derry are a must, but there's much more. Guide Lynn Corkin joins me today from Northern Ireland in our studio to talk about the underrated region of the United Kingdom. Lynn, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Rick. Thanks for having me.
It must be interesting to be from Northern Ireland, to be a guide, a professional guide in Northern Ireland, and to sort through the complicated history and to help people appreciate that, hey, we're doing our best and there's lots to do up here.
Well, most people who come to Ireland, if they've been before, they've been to the Republic of Ireland. And for all the obvious reasons of our recent history, they avoided Northern Ireland. So it's always a joy to show them the absolutely stunning countryside and the fascinating history. It's a different history from Dublin or Cork or Limerick or Galway, but it's just as interesting. And we have wonderful tourist attractions now as well. And actually, since the Good Friday Agreement of 1998, which is really the document, the treaty that brought the Troubles to an end, tourism in Northern Ireland has really taken off.
You know, I feel before that, it was frankly kind of depressing almost. It was glum. Yeah. The economy was bad. You just felt like, why would you come here for a vacation? It was heartbreaking. And that's almost 25 years now. But since then, Northern Ireland is just thriving. You go to Belfast and it's edgy, it's creative, it's vibrant, it's enjoying great food.
Yes.
It must be.
Food seems wonderful now compared to what it was.
Oh, God.
And I know it wasn't good, but Northern Ireland, I think agriculture is the single biggest income generating sector. And then tourism.
Tourism. Yeah.
And I'm old enough to remember meeting a French couple in Belfast and saying, are you sure you mean to be here? This isn't Dublin. You've got off the train at the wrong spot.
I remember the first time I took a group, one of our little minibus tours, I was driving the bus and we went to Derry and the mayor was so amazed that there was a group of Americans that he invited us into his mansion.
In the Guildhall.
In the Guildhall. Yeah. And we had a private audience with the mayor of Derry.
To make you feel welcome. Thank you for coming.
Because he says, thank you for coming to our town. Nobody comes here.
I know.
Well, that was a long time ago because a lot of people go to Derry and to Belfast, into the beauties of Northern Ireland. Now, let's talk before we get into specifics.
Northern Ireland is part of Ulster. Ulster is one of the historic regions of the island of Ireland. Mm-hmm. But Northern Ireland, that part of the United Kingdom, is most of Ulster in the north of Ireland.
Yeah. The six northeastern counties of the island of Ireland are Northern Ireland, but they are part of the province of Ulster, which is nine counties.
Oh, and there you go. So three of those are part of the Republic.
Three of those. Donegal, Monaghan and Cavan are part of the Republic of Ireland.
For a lot of people, they think of Ireland and it's mostly Catholic, St. Patrick, the three-leaf clover, the Emerald Isle of saints and scholars and all of that. And Northern Ireland, it doesn't have quite that romance. You know, it's London ruled. It's mostly Protestant. But the more you know it, the more you realize it's its own brand of Irishness. How would you defend Northern Ireland when people just want to see shamrocks and leprechauns?
The population, the religious balance of the population now of Northern Ireland is sort of 50-50,
yeah.
Really. I remember a writer, travel writer, Dervla Murphy, she called Northern Ireland a place apart.
Yes.
And it does have that quality all the years of British rule over the whole of Ireland. Ulster, the northern province, it was the furthest from Dublin. It was the furthest from English rule. It was the most rebellious, the most Gaelic, the wildest, the most inaccessible. And then the plantation of Ulster happened in the 1600s.
So let's talk about that first of all. So England was the great colonial empire. You
yes.
know? And you could say the first colony that England conquered and ruled was Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not easy. And the English, in order to control Ireland, planted settlers from Scotland into Northern Ireland, which, as you said, was the most spirited and Celtic and mm-hmm. Irish, you know. And it plants a lot of seeds of discord and problems, and that kind of shaped the history, didn't it?
It really did shape the history. History changed forever because I suppose it's incontestable that the local population, the native Irish Catholic population, were displaced to the west of the north of Ireland to make room for these new settlers from Scotland.
Wasn't there a phrase, go to hell or go to Connemara?
Go to hell or Connaught. Cromwell gave the native Irish the choice to hell or Connaught, which, of course, rainfall is heaviest in the west. The land is poorer. The land is much richer in the east. And so when these Scottish settlers arrived in the north of Ireland, they settled primarily in the counties of Antrim and Down because they were the closest to Scotland, 13 miles away.
Yeah.
And to this day, the River Bann, which runs down the middle of Northern Ireland, most Protestants live to the east of the River Bann, nearest to Scotland.
Oh, yeah.
And most Catholics live to the west.
And it is interesting for you to say that in the north of Ireland, which we think of as Protestant, it's 50-50.
It's 50-50 religious balance now.
So there you go. And I often think of Belfast, the major city of Northern Ireland, the capital, as a sister city of Glasgow.
Yeah.
They're both industrial cities, great ports, you know, shipbuilding.
Yes.
And a lot of cultural connections.
A lot of similarities. Even it looks similar. The city centre of Belfast would resemble Glasgow. And of course, the northern accent, which I have, often a lot of English people might think we're Scottish because to them we sound Scottish.
We're looking at the many ways you can explore Northern Ireland right now on Travel with Rick Steves. Blue Badge certified guide Lynn Corkin lives just outside Belfast in County Down. Her themed tours include the Van Morrison Trail and can be conducted in Spanish, Portuguese, and French. We provide links to our guests in the notes for each week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. And just in a nutshell, Lynn, what is the latest on the Troubles? Because it was such a tragic thing when I was younger, and now it feels like the Protestant and Catholic communities have learned to, if not embrace each other, at least realize that violence is not going to be a solution and we'll live together.
I think we are learning to live with each other. I mean, the success of the Good Friday Agreement, which, you know, was thanks to many politicians, but for your audience, President Clinton and Senator George Mitchell played a key role. And we're all very grateful for their interest in our little part of the world. But 25 years since the Good Friday Agreement, it's not completely all peace and love just yet, but people are learning to live together. And one of the great things, I think, is the young generation study this period in history in school, just like we studied the Second World War.
Yeah.
For them, it's history.
It's history. Well, that's a beautiful thing.
And that's wonderful.
That's a beautiful thing.
That is wonderful.
In Belfast, of course, you've got the sectarian neighborhoods,
yeah.
the Protestant and the Catholic neighborhoods and the Peace Wall and the memorials and the graveyards. And I want to stress, we always say Catholic and Protestant. It doesn't mean religious as much as that's the cultural basis. You know, the Protestants are the loyalists to London, and the Catholics, whether they go to Mass or not, they are in favor of Irish independence, I think. So it's kind of a misnomer to be simply calling it a religious thing,
yeah.
because it's much, much more than that.
I wouldn't call it
yeah.
that. You know, we would say more nationalist Republican community
yeah.
and the loyalist unionist community. And really, you know, the differences and the violence and all the rest of it was not about people's different interpretation of the Bible or religion. It was more about people's cultural and
yeah.
political identity,
yeah.
which often coincides with their given religion at birth.
Yeah.
It's just the way it is.
Yeah. I got to say, Lynn, in the United States, we've got a lot of deep divisions in our political discourse right now. And there's actually people in our country that feel curious about having a civil war. I mean, I think they're serious. We had a civil war back in the middle of the 1800s. Mm-hmm. You had a civil war in the 1920s.
Yeah.
And you just got through a civil war period with the Troubles.
Mm-hmm.
How is it? How is the civil war? Is that something that's kind of worth the trouble?
It's not something you want. The sorrow of the families, whichever side they were on, of all those who died, and the long-lasting intergenerational trauma, it's called, in Northern Ireland,
yeah.
where the grandson of somebody who was killed or injured in the Troubles, or the granddaughter, they suffer this intergenerational trauma that's passed down through the families.
Intergenerational trauma. So if we,
yeah.
if a society decides to go to the civil war to sort out its differences, generations later, their loved ones, their family will be paying the price.
It seems to be that way
that's
in
your
Northern
experience
Ireland.
In Ireland.
Yes.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. I'm talking with Lynn Corkin. She's a guide from Northern Ireland. Our phone number is 877-333-7425. And you can email us at radio@ricksteves.com. Jay's on the line from Cherry Hill in New Jersey. Hey, Jay.
Hey, Rick. Hey, Lynn.
Hello.
Thanks for your call. What's on your mind, Jay?
So Belfast has been on my bucket list for a long time. And I'm wondering, how do I honor and bear witness to the rocky and sometimes violent political history you guys were referring to, but also, you know, have a really great time?
Mm-hmm. Can that's
I do
a very good question.
The heavy side of that, but also have fun?
Well, that's what most people do when they come to Belfast. They manage to combine both. A lot of people will take a private tour, a taxi tour around the Peace Walls to see the political murals. This would be the Falls Road Shankill area in West Belfast. And in that sense, you are honouring those who died. It's a very sad symbol of the continuing division in some parts of Belfast. Also in Derry, you know, you could go to various memorials, including Bloody Sunday, to honour those who died during the Troubles. And there were almost 4,000 people from all walks of life in Northern Ireland and beyond it. There's also a great exhibition on the history of the Troubles in the Ulster Museum in Belfast beside Queen's. But, you know, it's not just that. It's not just Troubles tourism. There are major now tourist attractions. Titanic Belfast is now the number one tourist attraction in Northern Ireland. Second is the Giant's Causeway, which is up in the beautiful Antrim coast. And, of course, Belfast nightlife, Belfast restaurants, Belfast pubs, and the same in Derry and many points in between, just for what we call crack, general crack in the pubs. You don't know who you'll meet.
So that's interesting. You've got three things here. We've got honoring the Troubles and learning from the history, and there's plenty of ways to do that, learning about both communities. The trendy thing now is to get a dual narrative taxi tour. Somebody from the Protestant community showing you the Protestant neighborhood, somebody from the Catholic neighborhood showing you so you don't get a one-sided view. There are all of the fun alternative sites that have nothing to do with the Troubles. And then there's the crack,
mm-hmm.
which means the convivial conversations, the energy in the pubs, the warm welcome. You've got that in the North every bit as vividly and enjoyably as in the Republic. And that is often underrated.
And one of the advantages for you as an American or any visitor to Northern Ireland, we're not jaded by tourism yet. We're still delighted that people come. So I think people will say, oh, where are you from? Oh, whereabouts are you from in America? And they're truly delighted to have you there.
This is true. I didn't realize that until you said it. But when you go to the north of Ireland, you are you're a triumph. You're somebody who's coming into the country with a curiosity and wanting to meet the people and to celebrate their story.
And people will be as curious about you as a tourist as you are about Ireland. So you'll get a warm welcome.
But Jay, I would say I'm glad you've got a curiosity and a respect for the lessons of recent history that we can all learn from. And there are plenty of great ways to connect with that, especially in Belfast and in Derry, okay?
I'll let you know how it goes.
Thank you very much.
Have a great time.
Thanks for your call. Very, very quickly, Lynn, in Belfast, of course, you've got the Titanic Quarter, which is amazing. I mean, Belfast built the Titanic,
and my great-grandfather worked on the Titanic. My uncle worked in the shipyard. My dad is sort of in the DNA of the city of Belfast.
But it really is.
The attraction, the Titanic Belfast, as it's called, is the largest Titanic attraction in the world. And I remember a lot of people when it was proposed back in, say, 2005, people were going, who's going to come years later to see something about Titanic?
So fun.
It never stops. I'm there regularly as a guide. They've updated it. They spent $4 million in the last year or two updating all the exhibits, and its popularity never fades.
Tour guide Lynn Corkin is sharing tips for visiting Northern Ireland right now on Travel with Rick Steves.
And Scott in Boca Raton in Florida has emailed us, and Scott writes, we spent a week in Northern Ireland in March. We spent St. Patrick's Day in Downpatrick and then stayed on the Antrim coast. We'd like to go back and we're curious about any hidden gems beyond the big sites for adults that the kids would like. Okay, so yeah, you know, everybody's going to go to Belfast and everybody hopes going to go to Derry. And if you think about the Antrim coast, that is the sort of the well-worn trail where you've got your whiskey tasting, you've got your ruined castle.
The rope bridge
and the Giant's Causeway, which is a geological spectacular place to hike and see all these formations. That's all great. Everybody knows about it. There's lots of crowds.
Mm-hmm.
What is a dimension of Ireland in the north that would be fun for families that is not going to be crowded?
A less explored part of Northern Ireland would be County Down. For example, it's very close to Scotland. You know, there's lots of seaside towns, really. They're not so touristy. But you could go down the beautiful Ards Peninsula. You could stop in Portaferry for lunch, cross over on the short ferry, like 5-10 minute ride over to Strangford, continue on down along the beautiful coastline, go to the town of Newcastle, which is a seaside town with lots of fun activities for kids, and then into the mountains of Mourne and just explore the forest park there and the beautiful scenery.
You know, a seaside town with fun activities for kids, that sounds to me a little bit like Blackpool or a little bit like Brighton or a little bit about Coney Island. Mm. I love that idea. In Northern Wales, there's a couple of old-fashioned resort towns
on the coast,
you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Lyril and Llandudno.
And I went there and it was great. And what was great about it was there was no American tourists there. There was just local people having a great time with their families.
Exactly. That's why I would recommend Newcastle, because it just isn't on that big tourist hit list.
Right.
So you're just going to be mixing
Take
with your local
kids
people.
There and you'll have some,
get fish and chips, get an ice cream, go on the amusements, go on the rides, you know.
Candy floss.
Candy floss, absolutely. Yes, you can't leave without having the candy floss. It's really bad for you.
What do we call it?
Cotton candy.
We call it cotton candy. Yeah, but
okay.
I love candy floss. So I love this small town, humble, amusement park kind of thing where the families are going and water fun and all of that.
And the beauty of Newcastle, it is where the mountains of Mourne come down to the sea, as in the song.
That's the song. I've got
so
a friend who lives there.
You're literally walking along the promenade with all the amusements and the swimming pool and the sea and the beach. But the mountains of Mourne, which are glorious, the highest mountain in Northern Ireland is...
What is the song that where the mountains flow?
Percy French, where the mountains of Mourne sweep down to the sea.
Lynn, it's so fun to talk to you about Northern Ireland. I want to finish our conversation by going to the part of Ulster... That's part of the Republic, but it's way up in the northwest of Ireland. And I just want to be in a remote, beautiful, pristine piece of the British Isles in Ireland that is connecting to the sea. Where would I go?
Well, without hesitation, I would recommend Donegal. It's the most northern county of the whole of Ireland. It's up in the northwest. Fabulous beaches, very low population. Of course, a very sad reason why it's a low population, the famine and all the consequences of it. But my family, we all go, a huge group of us, every summer to Downings, for example. It's got one hotel, campsite, one pub, beautiful views, beautiful beaches, Tranarossen.
That sounds like a name I'd like you to spell. What is that?
Downings.
Downings.
Just a very small little village in Donegal, but very popular with people from Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
Not so many people come from Dublin or Cork or Kerry up to Donegal. It's too far. The communications aren't great. But for us in Northern Ireland, it's very close. And of course, it's part of the historic province of Ulster.
That's great.
Though one's in the Republic, one's in Northern Ireland, we've a lot in common as Northerners.
You know, that's a very good point that I hadn't even considered. You do have a little bit of Ulster spirit.
Yes.
You've got a lot of dynamics
going on. The rebel spirit.
Lynn Corkin, thanks so much, and I'll hope to see you in Northern Ireland someday soon.
Thank you very much.
From Baltimore up to Derry, and from Galway to Dublin town, no maid I've seen like the brown colleen that I met in the county down.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington, by Tim Tatton, Casimir Hall, and Donna Bardsley. Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court upload the shows to our website. Our theme music was written and performed by Jerry Frank. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. You can find links to our guests and search the show archives at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
With the Rick Steves Guidebook to England, Scotland, Ireland, or any place in Europe, I'll be right there with you as you put together the trip of a lifetime. They're each lovingly updated and carefully designed so you can travel smartly. Pick up the latest edition at your favorite bookseller or at ricksteves.com and make those travel dreams come true.